Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. I'm George Taylor. Today is podcast number 47. In the past couple of weeks, we've looked at a couple of new books I'm working on and which will be available in March, as well as a past book, which is now available. So let me remind you that A Study in Scarlet, the first of the Sherlock Holmes novels, is in production now. I'm also working on The Destined, a sci-fi tale for younger readers, which tells the story of five teens and their teacher who have been given special gifts to do one thing, and that's save the world from an evil force. Both books are exciting and fun. Look for them in March. Today I want to talk about the first of a three-book series. Nighthawk is the story of an amazing hero. The tale takes us from his birth and his raising, and then his years of seeking to find himself and his family. It's penned by author Jerry Minshew of Chattanooga, Tennessee. When you check his Facebook page, Jerry Minshew Publisher, you'll find reviews that give him a 4.6 stars out of a possible 5. Jerry is retired from full-time ministry, is an Air Force veteran, and of course now writes. So this book and its sequel, Nighthawk Vanishing Shadows, tells the story of Michael, who is kidnapped shortly after his birth by a couple who cannot have a child.
She was almost asleep when she heard the front door open. She rose from the bed, walked into the living room, and said, "Cindy, is that you?" When she entered the living room from the hallway, a strong arm grabbed her from behind and covered her mouth. Simultaneously, she felt a piece of cold metal against her temple. Suddenly, she realized that someone had a gun to her head. A man's voice said, "Listen, lady. Keep quiet. Do just like I say, and no one will get hurt." Carla felt fear like she had never felt before. Fear more for her children than for herself. She would give them anything as long as they did not harm her children. Then, as if the thief could read her mind, she heard a female ask, "Where are the kids?" The man asked, "Would you be a good girl and keep quiet?" Carla's eyes were open wide above his hand on her mouth. She nodded, and he spun her around so that she could see them. They wore ski masks and gloves. The female asked again, "Where are the kids?" Carla's face was white, and her legs were weak. When she spoke, her voice quivered. "You can have anything you want, just don't hurt my kids." With the gun just inches from her face, the man said, "Take us to them," she pleaded. "Please, don't." He grabbed her arm and pushed her down the hall. When they stepped into the nursery, the female said, "He's adorable." Carla realized that she had heard that voice before. The man said,
"Okay, babe, get him."
The man in the burger palace had called his wife Babe, and she had called him Jake. It dawned on her that these people were here for her children. As the masked woman reached over to the rail of the crib, Carla was filled with rage and reacted from instinct. She lunged at the woman and screamed, "No!" The twins woke up and started to cry. She pushed the abductor away from the crib and hit her in the face. She screamed, "I won't let you take him!" Jake grabbed her shoulder and she spun around. Her left hand grabbed the sleeve of his shirt and her right hand went for his eyes. He pushed her back and his shirt tore at the shoulder. She saw the name Lisa tattooed on his arm. Her face was red and the veins stuck out on her neck. "Get out of my house," Lisa said.
"You don't understand. I won't hurt him. I'll be a good mother to him," Carla screamed.
"I'm his mother." She attacked, grabbed the ski mask, and yanked it from Lisa's head. She threw it down and clutched her throat with both hands. They lost their balance and fell to the floor with Carla on top. Jake yelled,
"Stop, before I kill you!"
Carla choked harder and screamed, "You can't have my son!" She felt a sharp pain in her head, and everything went dark. Jake shouted,
"She shouldn't have done that. Now I'll have to kill her."
He pulled the hammer back on the pistol, but his wife interceded.
"No, honey, don't. That little girl will need a mother," Jake yelled in anger.
"But she can ID us. Besides, we'll just take the girl, too."
Lisa argued.
But I don't want a girl. I don't want two kids. I don't want twins. Remember, we talked about it. We want a son who can carry on your name.
But she can ID us,
Jake screamed.
She doesn't know our names, his wife pleaded. We haven't left any fingerprints. We can lock them in the closet. By the time they're found, we'll be long gone.
Jake finally conceded.
Go get the bottles so we can get out of here.
His wife hurried into the kitchen and soon returned with the two bottles. Carla was still unconscious, and Jake had moved her into the closet. Lisa took Michelle from the crib, put her on the floor in the closet next to her mother, and helped her hold the bottle in her little hands as she sucked on the nipple. Michelle stopped crying. Jake slammed the door shut, and Lisa walked to the dresser to get some diapers and clothes for Michael. Jake saw the door did not have a lock on it. He walked to the dresser, shoved his wife out of the way, closed the drawer that she had opened, and pushed the dresser up against the closet door. The drawers were now up against the door so that they were inaccessible. Lisa said,
I need to get him some more clothes.
Angrily, her husband said,
We'll buy him some more clothes. Now let's get out of here.
When Carla woke up, she sat against a wall. Her neck was stiff, her head ached. She looked around. It was a small room. The light was on. She looked up and saw Michael and Michelle's clothes. She was in their closet. She shouted, Where are my babies? She felt something touch her leg and looked down. Michelle looked up at her and laughed. Carla cried,
Where's Michael?
She searched around the closet. Michael! Michael, where are you? She jumped up and tried to open the door, but it was barricaded from the outside. She hit the door with her fist.
Michael! Michael, where are you?
Michelle started to cry, and Carla picked her up.
I'm sorry, baby. Mommy didn't mean to scare you.
She saw a half-empty bottle of milk on the floor. She picked it up and placed the nipple into Michelle's mouth.
It's okay, baby. Mommy's here. Everything's all right.
She leaned back against the wall, started to cry, and slid down to the floor.
How can I say that? I've let them take your brother.
Michael is taken while his twin sister Michelle remains at home. This sets up the first part of the adventure in this novel. Michael and Michelle's parents make every effort to find Michael, but twins have a special bond.
Michelle Walker stood on the steps of the schoolhouse waiting for her 7-year-old sister Cynthia to come out. When she did, Michelle took her by the hand and said,
Come on. Aunt Karen's here to pick us up.
Cynthia tried to pull her hand out of Michelle's grasp.
Don't hold my hand. I'm not a baby.
Michelle held on tight and said,
Mom told me to hold your hand until we get to the car.
When they got close enough to the car to speak to Aunt Karen, Michelle asked,
Did Mom and Dad call?
Karen said,
Yes, they did. Their meeting went well, and they will be home by the time school is out tomorrow, and they told me to give both of you a hug for them.
She gave the girls a hug, and they got into the car. Cynthia got into the back seat with her cousins, Angie and Chris. Michelle sat in the front seat and said,
I had a dream about my brother last night.
How do you know that the boy in your dreams was your brother?
I know because we were wearing our twin shirts. We were bigger, and the shirts were bigger, but they were the same shirts.
I guess that can happen in dreams. So tell me about it. We were walking in the woods, and Michael started climbing a tall tree. He climbed higher and higher, and when he was almost out of sight, he fell. But I caught him.
You caught him?
You must have been a strong girl in your dream.
I guess so, but what do you think it means?
I've never been good at interpreting dreams. I think that we usually dream about whatever is foremost on our minds. So maybe you had a dream about your brother because you've been thinking about him a lot lately. What do you think it means?
I've been thinking about it all day, and I think it means that I'm going to be the one to find him someday.
Jake and his girlfriend, Lisa, take Michael down to the Gulf Coast. Ultimately, Michael is raised by a foster family in South Alabama. After a particularly bad day at school, Michael's foster parents, Matthew and Teresa, share some information with him.
Michael followed his foster parents out of the bedroom and down the hall. At the end of the hallway, Matthew pulled a cord that let the attic stairs down. They climbed the stairs into the attic. There was a light in the center of the room. Matthew turned it on. Teresa walked over to a corner and removed a sheet from some boxes. Among the boxes was a suitcase. She picked it up and brought it closer to the light. She said to Michael,
"This belonged to your mama. The police gave it to us when they decided they didn't need it any longer. They kept your daddy's things because they might need something for evidence when they find him."
Michael opened the suitcase. The first thing to catch his attention was a tiny baseball shirt wrapped in plastic with the words "Twins" on the front. Just below the right shoulder, embroidered at an angle, was Michael's name. He unwrapped, unfolded the shirt, and turned it over and over in his hands as if it might hold some magical link to his past. Matthew said, "I've never been much of a baseball fan, but I think that's a Minnesota Twins shirt." Michael asked,
"Did they ever talk about Minnesota?"
"No," Matthew answered, "but they said that they were from California, and they never talked about California either. Actually, they never said much about their lives before coming here." As Michael ran his fingers over the shirt, he found the initials PW embroidered into the front hem. Teresa said,
"It's my guess that PW is the person who embroidered your name in the shirt. It's probably Jake's mother. The W probably stands for Weber. The P could be any number of names. They never mentioned any names with those initials."
Michael said,
"I could have a grandma and grandpa someplace wondering whatever happened to us."
Michael folded the shirt and wrapped the plastic back around it. He placed it back into the suitcase and picked up a shoebox. He removed a rubber band from around it. He removed the lid, and the first item to catch his attention was a photograph of a young lady holding a baby. The baby was wearing the baseball shirt.
"Is this my mama and me?"
"Yes, it is," Teresa answered.
"We don't know where that picture was taken, but it must have been somewhere on the Gulf Coast. You couldn't have been much older than that when you arrived here."
Michael placed the photo back into the shoebox and took out the remaining photos. There were about 20 of them. They were all pictures of Jake and Lisa in different settings: mountains, flatlands, canyons, oceans, etc. Matthew said, "Jake and Lisa obviously traveled a lot." Michael looked up and said,
"There are no more pictures of me."
Teresa said,
"You're right. I've always wondered about that myself. The way she fussed over you, I would have thought that she would have had more than one picture of you."
Michael put the photographs back in the box and looked at the other items: Jake and Lisa's marriage license, a dried rose, a movie ticket, and a seashell. Matthew put his hand on Michael's shoulder and said, "My people have always believed that for a man to know his destiny, he must first know his past. My people have a rich heritage. I can't imagine what it must be like to know nothing of your past. But I do know this. One day you will leave us. When you do, you will carry these items down the path that you will walk. Perhaps they will lead you to the answers that you seek."
And so that sets up the first element of this story, the search. Michael's family searches for him as Michael searches for his family. While this is a story of adventure and searching, there's plenty of time for humor. And in this segment, Michael has joined the Air Force in hopes that his service travels will help him find his family.
The dark blue bus full of recruits stopped in front of a white wooden building. Staff Sergeant Jack Armstrong stood waiting, wearing starched green fatigues with sharp creases and a smoky bear-style hat. He boarded the bus. With his hands on his hips and a stare that would stop a B-52 bomber, he yelled, "I'm Staff Sergeant Armstrong. It's my distinct privilege to welcome you to basic military training. I'm one of your training instructors. I'm the nice one. Your senior training instructor, Technical Sergeant Monmouth, is big and mean. You will not like him. You will like me. That is an order. I certainly hope that your stay here at Lackland Air Force Base will be an enjoyable one. I hope that I can be a close friend to each and every one of you. To that end, I'm going to allow you to be on a first-name basis with me. I'm going to allow you to address me by using my first name. My first name is Sir." There was a chuckle from somewhere in the bus. "Did I hear someone laughing?
Does someone think that my name is funny? Who laughed at my name?
A recruit in the middle of the bus spoke up.
I'm sorry, Sergeant. I thought you were making a joke.
In a heartbeat, Staff Sergeant Armstrong was down the aisle, bent over, staring into the eyes of the recruit who had spoken.
Joking? Do you think that this is all a joke? Let me tell you, boy, you will soon understand just how serious basic training is. What is your name, boy?
The recruit answered,
Eric Zadvanskaya.
Staff Sergeant Armstrong yelled,
What? I can't even say that, and I bet you can't even spell it.
Eric started spelling.
Z-A-V-O-D.
I don't want you to spell it. I want you to shut up.
I don't want you to speak unless I give you permission. In fact, I don't want you to breathe unless I give you permission. Furthermore, since I can't say your name, I'm going to give you a name that I can say. For the next 6 weeks, you will be Airman Alphabet. Is that understood?
Eric said, Yes, sir.
What is my first name, Airman Alphabet?
Eric answered, Sir. As Staff Sergeant Armstrong walked back to the front of the bus, he shouted,
Very good! Now, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted by Airman Alphabet, when you address a training instructor, the first word out of your mouth will be Sir, and the last word out of your mouth will be Sir. Look out the window to your right. That building is a chow hall. Training instructors are very sensitive people. I realize that you have been traveling all day and are probably hungry, so we are going to feed you. This particular chow hall is affectionately known as Hell's Kitchen. That name has nothing to do with the quality of the food. We call it that because it is operated by a sergeant who is demon-possessed. If you are so sloppy as to drop or spill anything on his floor, then he will make your life so miserable that you will think that you have died and gone to hell. Do I make myself clear?
All the recruits yelled,
Sir! Yes, sir! Very good! I'm impressed! Now let's see if you can continue to impress me. On my command, you will exit the bus, taking your hand-carried luggage with you. You will enter the chow hall, placing your hand-carried luggage on the floor in the foyer. You will proceed to the dining area, get your food, and eat in silence. When you are finished eating, you will proceed back through the foyer, retrieving your hand-carried luggage, and get back on the bus. From the time you exit the bus until you return to the bus will be 15 minutes. If you are not back on the bus within 15 minutes, the bus will leave without you. You will be left to wander the streets of Lackland Air Force Base in the dark. Since you do not have a military ID, you will be picked up by the Air Force Security Police and thrown into jail. Do I make myself clear?
Sir! Yes, sir!
I can't hear you!
Sir! Yes, sir!
Staff Sergeant Armstrong stepped off the bus and shouted,
Okay, everybody off the bus now. Move it, move it, move it.
The recruits poured off the bus as if it were on fire. They ran into the chow hall, dropped their luggage in the foyer, and proceeded into the dining area. Once inside, a squad of cooks started yelling orders.
Come on, move it, line up, over there. What do you want? Speak up.
What do you think I am, a mind reader or something?
Don't point at the food. Didn't your mama teach you to talk?
Eric got his food and sat down at the table. He said to the recruit sitting across from him,
Hi, I'm Eric Zadvanskaya. People usually call me Eric or Zavo. I guess you could call me Airman Alphabet, like the Sarge.
Almost in a whisper, the other recruit said,
I'm Michael Weber, but I don't think that we're supposed to be talking.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? What's a guy supposed to do? Shut up? Don't shut up. Speak up. Talk. Don't talk. What do you want? I wish they'd make up their minds.
Suddenly, Staff Sergeant Armstrong was about 2 inches from Eric's ear, shouting,
What is your problem, Alphabet? Can you not follow simple instructions? What part of eat silently did you not understand? Didn't your mummy teach you not to talk with food in your mouth?
Eric started to say something, but Staff Sergeant Armstrong cut him off by shouting,
Don't say it! Whatever it is, don't say it! I do not want to hear the sound of your voice any more tonight! Is that clear?
Eric didn't say anything. He just sat there, staring straight ahead.
I ask you a question, Alphabet. What's the matter? Are you deaf? I said, is that clear?
Eric was trying to figure out how he could answer without speaking. He finally, slowly nodded his head, yes.
Good boy, there may be hope for you yet.
No story of a young man in the service would be complete without some romance, and Michael definitely has that going for him.
It was Saturday night, and Michael and his four friends were enjoying the music of a local rock and roll band in the Airmen's Club. The club was packed full of recruits, all nearly bald, wearing the suntan-colored 1505 uniform. From behind him, Michael heard a familiar female voice.
What does a girl have to do to get a guy to ask her to dance?
All five of the guys turned at once. Michael glanced at his friends, hesitating just long enough to be sure that she was actually talking to him.
Dropping a hint would probably work for me.
Consider it dropped.
In that case, Staff Sergeant Island, could I have the pleasure of this dance?
Why, Michael, I thought you'd never ask. By the way, I'm in civvies tonight, so it's Janice.
Michael was thrilled to see that she had remembered his first name. As they walked out onto the dance floor, he grinned back over his shoulder at his friends. They laughed, whooped, and hollered, and slapped each other on the back. Eric wanted to know, "Hey, what's he got that we don't got?" Frank corrected Eric's grammar. "What does he have that we don't have?" Eric said.
"Yeah, man, that's what I'd like to know."
Greg answered the question.
"I can tell you exactly what he has that we don't have."
And they all said, "What?"
"A girl,"
he replied. Hank added,
"The boy does seem to live a charmed life, doesn't he?"
After several dances, Michael and Janice walked back to the sidelines to join their friends.
"You're a good dancer," Janice complimented him.
"I was raised by Indians, and we did rain dances every summer for the crops."
"Okay. Did they teach you how to bowl, too?"
"Actually, no. We didn't have a bowling alley on the reservation." Frank stepped forward and said,
"I know how to bowl."
Glancing at his nameplate over his pocket, Janice asked,
"And what is your first name, Airman Baker?"
"Airman Frank Baker, from Phoenix, Arizona, at your service, ma'am."
"Well, Frank, why don't you and the rest of the guys come with us, and we can teach Michael how to bowl?"
That wasn't quite what Frank had in mind.
Okay.
After a twisted smile, he glanced at Michael, who was beaming from ear to ear. After a couple of hours in the base bowling alley, Greg said,
"Guys, I hate to throw a wet towel on a good party, but we do have to be back at the barracks before lights out at 2100 hours.
Janice said, "I guess you guys better go. I don't want to be responsible for you getting into trouble." Looking directly at Michael, she asked,
"Do you have time to walk me to my barracks?"
"Absolutely. I found that you have to make time for the important things in life."
Turning to his buddies, he said, "I'll meet y'all back at the barracks."
Henry said, "Hey, we can take a hint. We know when we're not wanted."
Walking down the sidewalk, Michael was relieved that they were finally alone.
"So, why does a girl like you join the Air Force?"
"My family says that it's because I'm crazy. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, lived in the same house all my life, sat in the same pew in the same church all my life, went to the same school for 12 years, dated the same guy all through high school, and was slated to go to the same college that my parents and my three older brothers and my two older sisters went to."
"It sounds like you wanted a little less predictability in your life."
"Exactly. I needed to do something different. Nobody in my family had been to the military since World War II. I figured, since I was throwing away a college scholarship, that the military would give me the option of going to college later if I chose to."
"So what happened to the boyfriend?"
"He graduated 2 years before me and went to a local business college that offered a 2-year degree. He started training to take over his father's lumber business. We were to be married. I was to go to college, and after graduation he would be ready to start a family. Then I was to stay home and raise his kids and be a housewife and a mother like my mother and my older sisters. So I blew everybody's mind by breaking off the engagement 6 weeks before the wedding and joining the Air Force. Do you think I'm crazy?"
"My foster father is a Native American Indian, and..."
"So you weren't kidding about being raised by Indians?"
"Not entirely. My foster mother is a blonde pale face, as he calls her. I was kidding about the rain dances in the reservation. Anyway, he had all these wise old Indian sayings that I suspect he made up. Well, one of them went like this. If the deer walks the same path that the bear walks, then the deer will be eaten. The deer must create its own path. So I think that you're creating your own path, and that's good. Janice stopped in front of her barracks.
Sounds like your foster father was a wise man. What happened to your parents?
My mother died, and my father left me alone. The Brodies took me in.
Michael, you're a very interesting person. I'd like to hear more of your story, but this is where I get off.
Will I ever see you again?
If you get a chance to get back to the Airmen's Club, look around.
She raised her hand to his face and gently caressed his cheek. He was 4 inches taller, so she raised herself up on her toes and kissed him on the other cheek. She turned to walk away, but he grabbed her hand to stop her. He gently pulled her closer, put his arms around her, and passionately kissed her. When their lips finally parted, she said,
"Yes, you will definitely see me again."
All right, we have a story with a search for family, a story which includes humor, and there's some romance thrown in. What else can we put in this? How about a little science fiction?
Howard and Kelly sat in the viewing booth watching the NASA engineers and technicians working at their stations. Over the speaker in the corner of the room, they could hear,
"Reentry in 10, 9, 8, abort countdown. We have a problem."
Howard and Kelly stood and walked to the glass that separated them from the control room. They could see people working and talking to each other, but they couldn't hear what was being said. Howard looked at Kelly. "I'm going down there." He started for the door, and Kelly followed. They descended the stairs and entered the control room.
"Peter, what's happening?"
Peter looked calm, and that made them feel better.
"It's an unusual event, but we've got it under control. The port booster rockets apparently malfunctioned and fired prematurely, sending Neptune out of its orbit back out into space. We fired starboard boosters to correct and bring it back into orbit. We missed re-entry, but we'll just bring it around again. It'll be about another 90 minutes. Hope you weren't planning on getting to bed early."
Peter's calm demeanor was shaken when they heard, "We have another malfunction. Port booster rockets have fired again."
"I don't believe this. It looks like Neptune doesn't want to come home. Let's show him who the boss is. Fire starboard boosters."
"Starboard boosters fired. Course corrected."
Peter walked over to a console and spoke to the operator. "How much fuel do we have left?"
"Enough for one more fire."
Peter addressed the entire room. Those who could look his way did so. Others kept their eyes on their instruments.
"Okay, people, here's where we stand. If the port booster rockets malfunction and fire again, Neptune will be gone into space, lost to us forever. If we cause re-entry now, it could come down over land. If we burn the remainder of the fuel, it'll remain in orbit for months, maybe a year. Eventually, the orbit will decay, resulting in an uncontrolled re-entry. Neptune will burn up in the atmosphere, and the contents of the cylinder will be exposed to the atmosphere. It's my opinion that a controlled re-entry now is our best option. Deployment of the parachutes should minimize damage."
Kelly said, "Peter, what about human life? I say let it go out into space. That's the option with the least danger to people."
Peter spoke to an operator watching a radar screen.
"Wesley, if we bring it down now, where's it going to land?"
Wesley never looked away from his screen. He had already done the calculations.
"Southwestern United States, Texas, and New Mexico."
Peter looked back to Kelly.
"Sparsely populated. We have time to alert local, state, and federal emergency personnel. With all the fuel burned, the only chance of explosion will be if the space gas is volatile. The cylinder could possibly survive the crash. In that case, there will be no explosion."
A female operator turned away from her console.
"Peter, based on the time span between the first two malfunctions, we don't have much time."
Peter said,
"Okay, people, unless someone has an objection with a better solution."
He looked around the room. No one said anything.
"Curtis, fire starboard booster rockets."
"Starboard booster rockets fired. Reentry in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have reentry."
General Doug Eaton was brushing his teeth in the master bathroom when the telephone rang. Mrs. Eaton said,
I'll get it.
Doug said, if it's for me, tell them I've gone fishing in Alaska. I'll be back in 2 months.
Of course it's for you. My friends are too polite to call this late at night.
Picking up the receiver, she said,
hello, General Eaton's residence.
She listened for a few seconds and said,
sure, just a second.
She laid the receiver on the nightstand.
Doug, it's Colonel Fairchild. There's some sort of emergency.
Doug finished his teeth, walked to the side of the bed, and picked up the receiver. What's up, Jim?
James Fairchild said,
General, I really hate to bother you this late at night. However, the command post just received a call from NASA. It seems they've lost control of a satellite on reentry. Their best guess is that it'll hit somewhere near here.
Doug said, hopefully it'll pick somewhere out in the desert instead of downtown Alamogordo. Has local law enforcement been notified?
That's affirmative, General, but that's not all. It has a radioactive payload.
Is it a nuke?
No, sir. It's some type of radioactive gas encased in a cylinder. If the cylinder survives impact, they want it back ASAP.
I'm worried about what happens if it doesn't survive impact. What the devil are those eggheads doing anyway?
I don't know, sir.
Okay, let's get some men in the air, but advise caution. We don't want one of our guys going nose-to-nose with that thing. Oh, Jim, you'd better alert RADCOM. We may need their facilities.
Yes, sir, I'm on it.
Peter had never been afraid of leadership. One of the reasons that he'd been promoted to his current position was his ability to process information and to make split-second decisions. He rarely questioned his own judgment. Right now, he was experiencing one of those rare moments. Perhaps it would have been better to take a chance on losing the satellite to outer space. Instead, it was now plummeting toward the Earth at a breakneck speed. Had he allowed politicians and budgets to override his concern for public safety? Or was it the scientist in him that led him to make this decision? The cylinder aboard that satellite contained a substance never before encountered by humans. The survival of that cylinder was now dependent on the deployment of 3 parachutes. As if she had been listening to his thoughts, Kelly asked,
"When will the parachutes open?"
Peter answered,
"They will deploy automatically at 15,000 feet.
What if they don't?
Ordinarily, I'd say that we've never had chutes fail to deploy, but we've never had booster rockets fire themselves either.
Howard said, there's one thing that concerns me. We don't know what that space gas consists of. What if it's volatile, like you suggested?
The chutes will slow the satellite's rate of descent enough that the cylinder will remain intact. It was designed with that safety factor in mind. If the chutes fail and the substance is volatile, then there will be an explosion. However, those are contingencies that we'll only have to consider in 1 minute.
Peter pointed at the clock that was counting down the time to chute deployment. They sat in silence, listening to the voice of a controller count down the seconds. Kelly took a breath and held it, while the controller said, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, negative chute deployment. Peter hung his head in frustration and ran his fingers through his hair.
Manual override,
the controller repeated. Manual override. After a slight pause, he said, negative chute deployment.
Try again.
Trying again. After another pause, negative chute deployment.
Peter ran his fingers through his hair, looked at Howard, and asked,
could that gas, even enclosed in an airtight container, be affecting the operation of that satellite?
Peter, as far as we know, we're dealing with something here that is previously unknown to man. Anything is possible.
Michael was a mile into his 2-mile run. At least he thought it was a mile. His mind was so preoccupied with the events of the day that it found it difficult to concentrate on breathing and counting laps. He rounded the north end of the track so that he was facing an open field. Across the field were the BX commissary and the base chapel. Passing in front of these buildings was a patrol vehicle with its red and blue lights flashing. To the right of the BX in the base housing area was another patrol vehicle with its lights flashing. He looked to his left and saw an additional patrol vehicle with its lights flashing.
He wondered what was going on. He'd seen several F-4 Phantoms taking off a little while earlier. He'd assumed that they were running night exercises. Perhaps the security police were participating. He stopped running and started walking with his hands on his hips, sucking in deep breaths of fresh air. Suddenly, the alert whistle began to blow. It must be a base-wide alert. Technically, he could be considered on leave until midnight, but he decided that he was here, he may as well respond. A thunderous noise overhead caught his attention. He looked up to see the exhaust flames of two F-4s streak overhead, turn upward, and climb into the night sky. One of them peeled away to the east, and the other peeled away to the south. Then he saw another light, higher in the sky. He thought at first that it was the plume of a third jet. Then he realized that this flame was not moving away, but coming closer. He exclaimed aloud, "Oh, no, this is the real thing." He started running. He had to get to his barracks, get into uniform, and report for duty. Looking back over his shoulder, he saw that the two F-4s had looped around. One of them fired a missile. He stopped running and watched. The other jet fired a missile. Then the strangest thing happened. The target made an evasive maneuver just as the first missile appeared to have been deflected by an invisible force shield. The target made another evasive maneuver, and the second missile was deflected into the desert. Michael watched with amazement until he realized that the target had changed its course. It was now headed directly for the athletic field. He turned and ran, faster than he had ever thought possible. The adrenaline pumping through his body removed any fatigue or pain. His very life depended on getting as far away from the athletic field as possible. The last sound that he heard was what sounded like a sonic boom. He felt the force of the explosion against his body. It lifted him off the ground. The flames engulfed him in intense heat, and he lost consciousness.
So, what happens to Michael now? He's looking for his family. Will he find him? He's found a young lady. Will they form a lasting relationship? And he's encountered something that no one else has ever encountered. What does that do to him? Well, you're going to have to read or listen to the entire book in order to find out. You can find the book on my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com/books. Scroll down about halfway to the adventure section and click on the icon for Nighthawk. I'd love to hear from you. Send me a message on Facebook to Narration by George, or on Twitter, I'm @NarrationByGeo, or you can email me, george@narrationbygeorge.com. Let me know what you think. We'll take a look at the sequel to this book next week. In the meanwhile, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with others. See you next week.